His and Samantha's surviving children had accompanied them into voluntary exile, and he encouraged them to continue thinking of themselves as Carisians. Samantha lacked the heart to tell him, yet her own advice was quite different. In fact, she had encouraged them to find homes outside the Carisian quarter and do their very best to integrate into the Sidamachian community. She loved her homeland as much as Cletan ever had, but unlike him, she was able to admit, and too self-honest to deny, that the Church of Caris wasn't going away. Cletan would never see his dreamed-of, longed-for peaceful reconciliation with the temple. If the heretical church was brought down, it would fall only to the sword, and the carnage and retribution would destroy the kingdom he remembered so lovingly. The ashes would poison the ground and bear bitter fruit for generations to come, and she would not see her family poisoned in turn by clinging to an identity which was doomed. Better, far better for them to recognize reality and become the Sidamachians into which fate and their faith in God had transformed them. She and Cletan would die here in Sidar City, be buried in the Republic's alien soil, still dreaming of the past they could never hope to reclaim. And she would never even hint to him that she had realized that hope could never have been more than a dream. But not every Carisian living in the Republic shared that attitude. The fracture lines within the rapidly growing Carisian community here in Sidar City grew deeper and uglier with every passing day. Over a third of its members were here not because they'd fled Caris out of religious principle, but because this was where trade and commerce had brought them long before the current warfare had erupted. The swelling influx of newcomers were as much temple loyalist as she and Cletan could ever be, yet even a growing faction of them were being attracted to the reformist elements within the mainland church. And nowhere were those reformist elements stronger than here in the Republic. Many a Sidamachian, and even many of the Carisian emigres who'd turned their backs in horror on the open schism of the Church of Caris, found the condemnations of clerics like Michael Stainer resonating with their own disappointment in what the vicarate and the church had become in the hands of men like Zamsin Trinair and Zaspar Clintan. Schism they would not condone. Reform they were prepared to respectfully demand. Samantha Rayman was a shrewd, clear-eyed observer, determined to protect her family, and the shadows were growing darker, even here in the Republic. Cletan sensed it too, and despite his own sympathy for much of the reformist argument, he resolutely refused to embrace it. Neither would Samantha, for she had seen only too clearly the horrors of which Zaspar Clintan's Inquisition was capable. She recognized the danger hovering in the reformist label, even here in the Republic, where the Inquisition's writ ran less deeply. And that was the true reason she longed to pry her grandson gently away from Eva Parsan. She had begun picking up whispers that the brilliant, witty, wealthy beauty who had taken Sidar City's society by storm looked with favour upon the reformist movement. As always, Madame Parsan spoke gently and calmly, championing peaceful reform, condemning violence, couching her murmured arguments in terms of love and compassion. No reasonable soul could possibly have accused her of the least impropriety. But these were not the times for reasonable souls. "Be careful, Burke," she thought after the grandson she'd raised. "Oh, be careful, my love. You're too much like your grandfather. You try to hide it, but beneath that surface you show the world. You feel too deeply, and there's too much integrity for times like these. Forget you're a Carisian, and remember to be cautious. Be Sidamachian, please." Thwap! Salie's Trascat stiffened as the well-rotted apple smacked him squarely between the shoulder blades, and then oozed down his back in trickles of brown pulp and slime. His head whipped around, looking for the hand which had thrown it. But no guilty expression gave away the culprit. Indeed, no one seemed to be looking his way, which said a great deal. His fists clenched at his side, but he managed, somehow, to keep the fury he felt out of his expression. It wasn't the first time something like that had happened. It wouldn't be the last either, he thought grimly. He was just lucky it had been an apple instead of a rock. And at least this time the bastard didn't shout anything, he thought. Fucking coward. Brave enough when he doesn't have to actually face someone, isn't he? Then he gave himself a mental shake. Just as well, too. If he had said anything, pointed himself out, I'd have had to do something about it, and Langhorne only knows where that would have ended. He bent back to his task, hoisting another bag of emeraldi and cocoa beans onto his shoulder and rejoining the line of longshoremen carrying them into the waiting warehouse. It didn't pay all that much, but it was better than the soup kitchens, and he was lucky to have the work. Enough people didn't, and in his calmer moments, he realized that was part of the reason for the hostility he encountered every day. But still... "See who it was?" a voice asked quietly as he entered the warehouse's dim cavern. He hefted his bag down on a pallet, then turned towards the speaker, and Franz Schumann, his shift foreman, raised an eyebrow at him. Schumann was Sidermarkian, but he was also a decent man, and he looked concerned. "Nope," Traskat shook his head and smiled, deliberately making light of it. "Just as well, I guess. Last thing we need is a riot down here on the docks just because some stupid bastard needed his head ripped off and shoved up his ass. Probably wouldn't have done me any good with the guard either, now that I think about it." "Probably putting it lightly," Schumann acknowledged with a chuckle. He seemed genuinely amused, but there was a note of warning in it too, Traskat thought. Not that it was necessary. "Well, as long as they stick to rotten fruit, it's not going to cost anything but another washing day for Myram," Traskat said as philosophically as he could. "If they start throwing rocks, like they did at the fish market last 5 days, though, it's going to get ugly, Franz." "I know." Schumann looked worried. "I'll have a word with the boss. See if we can't get a little more security down here. A couple of big bruisers with cudgels will probably cut down on this shit a lot." Traskat nodded. It might not too. A lot would depend on whether the troublemakers thought the big bruisers with the cudgels were there to help Traskat or them. "It's not just about you, you know," he reminded himself. "There's other Carisians down here on the docks too. And your lucky Schumann's thinking about getting someone down here to break the troublemakers' heads instead of how much simpler it would be just to fire your ass. I'm asking Haraz and Willem to keep an eye out for the rest of this shift," Schumann added. "Anybody else tries something, they'll spot him. And if he works for us, his ass is history. The boss doesn't like this kind of shit." "Thanks," Traskat said with quiet sincerity, and headed back for the next crate. The work was hard, often brutally so, and the job was a huge step down for a man who'd once been the Talisbird Kraken's starting first baseman. The pay was no more than 2/3 of what he had been making back in Talisburg, even for the same work either. Worse yet, it cost more to live here in Sidar City than it ever had back home. His wife, Myram, actually made more than he did, but she was a skilled weaver. The Carisian community living in Sidermark had always been heavily represented in the textile trade, and she'd been fortunate enough to find a job working for fellow Carisians. He was pretty sure her employers had embraced the Church of Caris, at least in private, but they were still good people, and he was glad Myram had found employment with them. He didn't want to think about her having to face the kind of daily harassment he encountered down here on the docks. It wasn't fair, but the writ had never promised life would be fair, only that God and the archangels would be just and compassionate at its end. That was enough for any man when it came down to it. But it was hard, Hard when the rotten apples came flying from anonymous hands. Hard when he had to face his older son, Martin, and try to explain why so many people hated him simply for being Carisian. And especially hard when someone shouted, "Heretic!" or "Blasphemer!" from the cover of darkness as they passed outside the tiny apartment, which was all he and Myram could afford, even here in the quarter. If they'd been heretics, they'd still be in Tellersburg, he thought grimly, still with the neighbours they'd grown up with, not estranged from their own families. They'd come to Sidar City because they couldn't be party to the schism, couldn't stand by and watch while God's own church was torn apart. No, they didn't like everything about the current situation in Zion. In fact, in the privacy of his own mind, Sales regarded Zaspar Clintan as an abomination, an indelible stain on the sanctity of Mother Church. But the writ and the commentaries made it abundantly clear that the Church was greater than those who served her. Their sins could not diminish her authority, nor could they absolve her children from their obedience to her. They had the right to protest, to seek redress when her servants fell short of their responsibilities. Indeed, they had a duty to insist her priesthood be worthy of their offices and the God they served. But that wasn't the same thing as throwing defiance into the Grand Vicar's own face. And it certainly wasn't the same thing as setting up the judgment of a mere provincial archbishop as superior to that of the archangels themselves. He felt the rage building in him again and forced himself to let go of it. It wasn't his business to judge other men. It was his job to make sure he met his own responsibilities and didn't help others avoid theirs. Those responsibilities included standing up for what he knew was right, and they included putting up with idiots who didn't understand as well. As long as he did what he knew was right, he could leave final judgments to Langhorn and God. He picked up another sack, settled it on his shoulder, and turned back towards the warehouse. "Fucking heretic," Samuel Nagel thought bitterly. "Should have thrown a damn rock. Hell." His lips drew back in an embittered snarl as he stood in the alley between the warehouses, glaring out at the busy scene. "I should have thrown a fucking knife." Nagel was only 17, but he knew what was going on. He knew who was to blame. His father had been a sailmaker and a good one, but never a prosperous one. That was the fucking Carisians' fault, too. Bad enough when everyone had known Carisians built the best ships in the world, whether they really did or not. The shipbuilders here in Sidar City had at least managed to keep their heads above water, and at least there'd been some work those days. But then the bastards had introduced their damned schooner rig and things have gotten even worse. Everybody had to have one of the new damned ships, and if you didn't know how the sails were cut, then you were just fucking out of luck as far as new orders went, weren't you? Besides, who could match the quality of the canvas coming out of Caris these days? And who could afford to buy the quality of canvas coming out of Caris? Nobody, that was who. And if that weren't enough, then the goddamn heretics had to launch their fucking schism against Mother Church. Of course they'd driven the Grand Inquisitor into declaring an embargo against trade with them. What else had they expected? But they'd had an answer for that too, hadn't they? Them and their buddies, the fat sand maggot bankers. Hell, half of them were Carisians too, weren't they? And they got their sodomite friends in the Lord Protector's government to go along with it. So now everyone was using Carisian ships, with Carisian crews, financed by Carisian money, and pretending they were Sidamarkian. Everybody knew better, but did it matter? No, of course it didn't. Whatever the registration papers might say, they were Carisian ships, and the Carisian privateers knew it. So they got safe passage while everyone else's shipping got wiped off the face of the ocean. The shippers and the warehouses and the longshoremen were still doing just fine. Them and their fucking Carisian friends. But the honest workers, the honest temple loyalist workers who couldn't find jobs as carpenters or sailmakers or chandlers or in the ropeworks, they were starving to death. Unless they wanted to go crawling to one of the soup kitchens, at least. But a man had his pride, and it wasn't right. It wasn't right for good, hard-working, believing Sidomarkians to be thrown out of work and forced to accept charity just to survive. His father hadn't been able to face it. They could say what they liked about accidents, but Samuel knew better. His father had always liked his beer, yes, but he'd never have gotten so drunk he staggered accidentally off the end of the wharf in the middle of winter and drowned, assuming he hadn't frozen to death first. And he'd been careful to arrange an apprenticeship with his older brother for Samuel first. No, it hadn't been an accident. He'd made it look like one so Mother Church would agree to bury him in holy ground, and he'd done what he could to take care of his boy first. It wasn't his fault Uncle Bert's sail loft had collapsed into bankruptcy as well. Samuel felt the hot tide sweeping up inside him again, but he fought it down. This wasn't the time. Master Bazkai and Father Samon were right about that. If they started actually attacking Carizians, really hurting the bastards the way they deserved, they were likely to actually generate some kind of sympathy for them. The very idea seemed impossible, but the city authorities were letting the damned heretics stay right here in Siddhar City, weren't they? If they were willing to whore themselves up for Carizian gold to that extent, then who knew where they'd be willing to go in the end? No, he thought, turning away and shoving his hands into his tunic pockets as he stamped angrily down the narrow, noisome alley, the time might come, but it hadn't come yet. Father Samin promised God and the archangels would smite the Carizians in the fullness of time. And for now, at least, Samuel Nagel would wait to see that happen. But if it didn't, he wasn't going to wait forever. "Good evening, Madame Parsan," Toby Sewell said. He knew he sounded more than a little stuffy, but he couldn't help it. Parsan was just as charming, witty, beautiful and wealthy as all her champions claimed, but he caught the stink of reform from her. "Good evening yourself, Master Sewell," Parsan replied, smiling at him and extending one slim hand. Appearances had to be maintained, and he bent over it, brushing it with his lips. "I hadn't expected to see you tonight," she continued as he straightened. "When my wife heard Shargatti would be performing at your party, she simply had to be here," he said. "Ah," Passan's smile broadened and turned impish. "I'd rather hoped it would have that effect," she confided, "and I have to admit, any excuse to listen to her sing was worthwhile." Sewell nodded, and she was right. Elisa Shargatti was the most highly sought-after soprano in all of Sidomak. She had travelled all the way to the Harchong Empire to study voice, and even the most sturdily Sidomakian critic had to acknowledge opera still attained its highest expression in the empire. She could command any venue or fee she chose, and the fact that this was the second party of Parsan's she had graced said a great deal about the woman's wealth. Either that, or it may say some unappetizing things about Shargatti's own religious leanings, he thought, looking around the assembled guests. "Well, I do hope you and your charming wife will enjoy yourselves this evening," Parsan said to him. "In the meantime, however, I see the Seneschal's wife has just come in. I'm afraid I'm going to have to meet my social obligations and greet her. If there's anything you need, please don't hesitate to ask one of my servants to see to it for you." She swept him a stylish half-curtsy with all the polished elegance only to be expected from someone who'd come from Zion itself. Then she moved away, smiling and gracious, strewing conversational tidbits in her wake, and Sewell watched her go with a sense of relief. If he was going to be honest, his dislike for her stemmed far less from religious principles than from the threat she represented. Personally, Sewell didn't really care who ran the temple. As far as he was concerned, that was God's business, and God would get around to straightening it out eventually if he wasn't happy about it. In the meantime, however, one of Mother Church's responsibilities was to see that people behaved themselves. And when people behaved themselves, there weren't things like wars and violence. And when there weren't things like wars and violence, simple bankers could engage in honest, gainful trade without having to worry about what the lunatics on either side were going to tear down, burn to the ground, or blow up next. Sewell considered himself as Carisian as the next man, but he had lived here in Siddur City for almost 30 years. He was part of the city, a known man, respected and listened to throughout the business community, not just in the quarter, with contacts at the highest level of the government. Or at least he was for now. There was no telling how long it would continue to be true, though, and it was the maniacs like Stainer and Emperor Caleb who were to blame. "Remember what the healers keep telling you about your temper, Tobis," he reminded himself. "The last thing you need is to work yourself into an apoplectic fit over things you can't do anything about anyway." He drew a deep breath, held it, and then exhaled slowly. His wife, Zandra, had taught him the technique, and it actually worked. Sometimes, anyway. Fortunately, this was one of the sometimes, and he felt his anger ease. A business colleague nodded to him in passing, and he managed to nod back with a genuine smile. Then he accepted a goblet of wine from one of Parsan's servants and sipped. "At least the woman's taste in wine is as good as her taste in music," he reflected morosely. "That's something, if I'm going to be stuck here all night anyway." He took another sip and began easing his way through the crowd, looking for his wife. "Good evening, Eva," a quiet voice said, and Eva Parsan turned to smile at the silver-haired man who didn't happen to be wearing a cassock this evening. "And good evening to you too, Zazin," she said tactfully, avoiding any last names or ecclesiastic titles. "You are aware the seneschal and his wife are both attending tonight, aren't you?" she added teasingly. "I assure you, I'll stay out of Lord Darius's way," he replied with a smile, "although, according to my sources, he'll probably be going pretty far out of his way himself to avoid noticing me. May I ask if your negotiations with him have prospered?" "Oh, I'm sure both the Republic and I will be making a great deal of money, Zazin," she assured him. "And it really won't hurt for Hanreman's foundries to get a small infusion of capital at a time like this." "Small?" He raised his eyebrows in polite incredulity, and she laughed. "Perhaps not so small on the scale of individuals," she acknowledged, "but still relatively small on the scale of entire realms." "Indeed," her smile faded slightly, "small enough I think there's an excellent chance none of Clintan's eyes or ears will realize it's even been made. For a while, at least." Zazin Khania nodded, although his eyes were worried. Madame Parsan's investment was nowhere near so cut and dried as she chose to pretend, and she was playing a more dangerous game than she was willing to admit. He was less certain than she that the Inquisition wouldn't get wind of a private investment which amounted to the purchase of several thousand rifled muskets and bayonets. More than that, he was more than a little frightened of exactly what she intended to do with them once she had them. "Perhaps it's just as well she hasn't enlightened you on that particular point," he told himself dryly. "You'd probably worry even more if you did know what she was going to do with them." "You have made it clear to your special guests that there's a degree of risk involved here, haven't you?" he asked now, changing the subject. "Of course I have, Zazin." She smiled and touched his cheek gently. I admire and respect you, my friend. But I'm not going to throw any lambs to the slash lizards without due consideration. I'm very careful about who I approach with your invitation, and after the initial flirtation, I'd be tempted to say seduction, if it wouldn't seem too much like a bad jest, given my previous vocation. I'm very careful to warn them about the dangers. And that's why I send them to you only one or two at a time. We can't avoid letting you and me know who they are, but we can at least protect their identities from anyone else. Forgive me. He smiled back and cupped his left hand lightly over the fingers on his cheek. I forget sometimes how long you've been doing this sort of thing. I should know better than to try to teach such a mistress of her art. Mistress of her art? She shook her head, eyes dancing. And here I went to such lengths to avoid any double entendres. My dear, I know it amuses you to try, but you're really not going to shock me or offend me by throwing your past into my face, he pointed out. I know, but you're right. It does amuse me. And it probably says something unfortunate about me as well. She shook her head, still smiling. My initial involvement in this sort of thing was quite what you might call a reaction against the high clergy, you know. I can't quite seem to forget that even though you're not like the vast majority of your ecclesiastic brethren, you are an archbishop. I think that's why I feel such a compulsion to keep trying. As long as it amuses you, he said, then looked across the room. Not to change the subject, although that's really exactly why I'm doing it. Who's that youngster with Sharkati? She turned to follow the direction of his glance. Which one? The younger of the two is Burke Rehman. He's Clayton Raymond's grandson, and I strongly suspect him of harbouring reformist thoughts. In fact, I'm not so sure he'd be happy stopping short of Church of Kairos-style thinking if he had his druthers, although he's far too astute and too well informed to come out and say anything of the sort. The fellow with him is Rafe Alexen. He's about 10 years older than young Raymond, and a Sidomachian. I've met his father. The family's got money, and I think they'd really prefer to sit on the sidelines. But I'm not sure about Rafe. Not yet. She frowned thoughtfully. I think there's some potential there, but given his family connections, I'm being particularly cautious about exploring it. She shrugged. In the meantime, he's really quite a good poet, and making him a more or less permanent fixture at my parties is something of a social coup. You actually enjoy this, don't you? He asked. She looked back at him and he shrugged. I mean, all of it. The scheming, outwitting your enemies, laying the evil low, the dancing on the edge of the sword blade. Not just all of that, but the parties and the gaiety, too. You do, don't you? Of course I do, Zazin. She seemed surprised by the question. It's what I do. Oh, her eyes hardened, although her smile never wavered. Don't think for one moment that I'm not going to dance in that pig Clintan's blood the day Caleb and Charlian take his head, and string up the rest of the group of four, and the entire damned vicarate, what's left of it, for that matter. Never underestimate that side of me, Zazin, or you may get hurt. But the rest? The hardness disappeared, and her eyes danced once more. It's the grandest game in the world, my friend. Beside this, anything else would be only half alive. He gazed at her for a moment, then shook his head, and she laughed. Take yourself off to the private salon now, Zazin, she told him. Your first meeting scheduled to begin in about 10 minutes. And in the meantime, she smiled brilliantly, I have to go have a word with the Seneschal. 2, The Prison Hulks and HMS Chihiro 50, Gorath Bay, Kingdom of Dolar. "How is he this morning, Niklas?" Sir Gwilymanthe asked, turning his back on the vista of Gorath Bay. "Not as well as he pretends, sir," Niklas Wallén replied. The slight, dapper valet joined the admiral at the forecastle rail and stroked his moustache gently as he too looked out across the bay. The sky was a blue bowl overhead, dotted with white cloud puffs and a brisk breeze, cool, but without the bitter bite of the winter just past, blew across the deck. Wyverns and seabirds rode the breeze, their cries and whistles faint, and 3-foot waves gave the deck underfoot a slight pitch as the ship's anchor held her head to the wind. Not that the obsolete coastal galley was much of a ship any more, Manthir reflected, gazing once more across the bay at the hateful sight of the city of Gorath's tall stone walls. He'd had almost too much opportunity to examine those walls over the last 7 months. He'd spent endless hours picturing how vulnerable they would be to modern artillery, and regretting the fact that he'd never have the chance to see that vulnerability demonstrated. He turned away from the familiar lava flow anger of that thought, not that the contemplation of his remaining command was any more appealing. Louis Gardiner, the Duke of Thesk, had done his best for his prisoners, better, to be honest, than Manthir had anticipated, after the unyielding terms then Crown Prince Caleb had inflicted upon him after the Battle of Crag Reach. But he had faced certain limitations, the greatest of which was that he appeared to be the only Dolaran aristocrat with anything remotely resembling a sense of honour. The others were too busy hating all Carizians for the crushing humiliation of the battles of Rock Point and Crag Reach. Either that, or they were temple loyalists, too busy sucking up to the Inquisition, or both, to worry about little things like the proper treatment of honourably surrendered prisoners of war. Manthir knew his own sense of failure and helplessness when he contemplated the probable future of the men and officers he'd commanded only made his bitterness worse. But when he looked around the mouldering old galleys which had been converted into prison hulks to house his personnel, when he considered how grudgingly their needs were met, how meagre their rations were, how little concern even the Order of Pasquale had demonstrated for his wounded and sick, it was hard to feel anything except bitterness. "Especially when you know the only thing standing between your people and the Inquisition is Thirsk. And, who would have believed it, a Shularite auxiliary bishop," he thought. He wasn't the only Carizian that bitterness was poisoning, he reminded himself. He and his surviving officers did all they could to maintain morale, but it was hard. Carizian seamen, by and large, were far from stupid, and even the youngest surviving ship's boy could figure out what was going on. Penned up in the drab, damp, barren sameness of their floating prisons day after day, denied the right to so much as send letters home to tell their families they were still alive, so far at least. Poorly fed, without exercise, with no warm clothing against a winter which would have been bitterly cold for anyone, far less men from their semi-tropical homeland. It was scarcely surprising when even Carizians found it difficult to pretend to one another that they couldn't see what was coming. "Which is one reason we've got so much sickness in the hulks," Manthir told himself bitterly. "Not that there aren't plenty of other reasons. Aside from thirst can make, none of these people give a good goddamn about whether or not heretic Carizians are covered by Pasquale's law. Hell, most of them probably figure heretics don't have any right to worry about Pasquale's commands. They're sure as hell not bothering themselves to provide the proper diet his law decrees anyway. No wonder we're actually seeing scurvy among the men. And when you crank that kind of so-called food into the living conditions, such as they are, and the despair, it's a wonder everyone isn't down sick." His jaw muscles ached, and he forced himself to deliberately unclench them. None of their chaplains had survived the final battle, which was probably just as well, since the Inquisition would most certainly have demanded and received possession of any heretical priests who fell into their hands. Mencia liked to think that at least some of the Dalaran clergy would have been interested in meeting the spiritual needs of his men. But they'd been forbidden to by Wilson Lanier, the bishop executor of Gorath, and Absalan Karmich, his intendant. If the rumour mill was to be believed, Bishop Stephen Make, the Dalaran Navy's special intendant, had attempted to get that ruling overturned. But if he had tried, he hadn't succeeded. Bishop Executor Wilson was willing to grant access to clergy for Corisians who were prepared to renounce and admit their heresy and the blasphemous rites in which they had participated in the worship of Shanwei. But that was as far as he was prepared to go. Which, since we haven't had any blasphemous rites, or worshipped Shanwei, would be just a bit difficult for any of them to do honestly. And all of us know from what happened to those poor bastards the Inquisition got hold of after the Fered massacre, Clintan would use any confessions against Karis. Not to mention the fact that admitting any such thing would make whoever confessed automatically subject to the punishment of Shula. And only a drooling idiot would believe someone like Clintan wouldn't get around to applying it sooner or later, no matter what Lanier might promise first. Despite that, some of his men, a few, no more than a couple of dozen, had recanted their heresy and been received back into the bosom of Mother Church, for now at least. Or so their fellows had been told, at any rate. Mantia had his doubts about how long that was going to last, and the constancy of the rest of his people in the face of what they all knew awaited them eventually had been one of his few sources of consolation over the past months. Yet even that consolation had been flawed with bitterness, and the despair was always there for everyone. It combined with all those other factors to drive down the men's ability and willingness to resist disease. And by his latest estimate, at least a third of his remaining personnel were currently ill. It had been worse over the winter months, in some ways, but malnutrition and privation hadn't yet reduced their resistance then. Now that spring's milder temperatures had arrived, the sick list should have been shrinking. Instead, it was climbing, and they were losing 3 or 4 men every 5 days. Men who were forbidden burial in consecrated ground as the spawn of Shanwei they were. Instead, their bodies were to be taken ashore on Archbishop Truman's personal orders and cast into pits in the fields where the Dalaran capital buried its garbage. Its other garbage, as the Holy Archbishop had put it. Which was why Mantia and his officers had taken to dropping their dead quietly and reverently over the side under cover of night, weighted with whatever they could find for the job, and accompanied by the murmured words of the burial service any captain remembered only too well. The numbers were going to get worse. He was almost certain of that. And he was desperately worried about young Lainser Sveasman, HMS Dancer's only surviving midshipman. Sveasman had lost his left leg, just below the hip, during the final, desperate hour of the action, which had hammered 4 of Manthea's ships into wrecks before they finally struck. The boy had been barely 12 and a half when they took off his leg, yet his courage had almost broken Manthea's heart. He and Valain had cared personally for Sveasman over the bitter winter just past, nursing him through his recovery, slipping him extra food from their own meagre rations, and denying they were doing anything of the sort whenever he asked. There'd been times, especially right after the amputation, when Manthea had been afraid they were going to lose the boy anyway, as he had lost so many other officers and men. But Sveasman had always pulled through, which only made his current illness even more heartbreaking to both of them, he admitted, looking back out across the bulwark, watching the guard boats now steadily, methodically around the prison hulks in their endless, unceasing circles. Not that even a Carisian seaman was going to try to swim ashore, in water still fanged with winter cold, from a hulk anchored the better part of a mile and a half from shore. "I think his temperature may have come down a little, Sir Gwillem," Verlaine offered. And Manthea glanced at him. The valet shrugged. "I know we both want to believe that, sir, but I really think it may be true in this case, if he just hadn't been so weakened already." His voice trailed off and Manthea nodded. Then he laid one hand on Verlaine's shoulder. "We've gotten him this far, Niklos. We're not going to lose him now." "Of course not, sir," the valet agreed gamely, and both of them tried to pretend they truly believed they weren't lying. "My lord, this is an act of murder," Lewis Gardner said flatly. He stood with his back to the stern windows of HMS Chihiro, his face like carven stone, and his eyes were hard. Not a large man, the Duke of Thirsk, but at that moment he seemed to fill the day cabin. "That isn't for you to judge, Lewis," Auxiliary Bishop Stephen Make replied. His own expression was set, his eyes grim, yet his voice was remarkably gentle for a Schulerite under the circumstances. "My lord, you know what's going to happen." Despair flickered behind the hardness in Thirsk's eyes. "We're both sons of Mother Church," Make said in a sterner tone. "It's not up to us to judge her actions, but rather to obey her commands." This time, Thirsk's eyes flashed, but he bit back an angry retort. He'd come to know the auxiliary bishop well, too well for either of their comfort and good, he sometimes thought, and he knew Make was no happier with this commander than he was. At the same time, the cleric had a point. It wasn't their place to judge the church's actions, even if, at this moment in time, her policies were being decided by bloody-handed murderers. "God!" the Earl demanded harshly in the stillness of his own mind. "How can you be letting this happen? Why are you letting this happen? This is wrong, I know it. Bishop Stephen knows it. Yet both of us are going to watch it happen anyway because your church commands it. What are you thinking?" A part of him cringed from the impiety of his own questions, yet he couldn't stop thinking them, couldn't stop wondering what part of the inscrutable mind of God could let someone like Zaspa Clintan attain to the Grand Inquisitor's chair. It made no sense to him, no matter how hard he tried to force it into some kind of order, some sort of pattern he could understand and accept. "But if I can't understand why it's happening," he thought, shoulders slumping, "I damn well understand what's happening." He wheeled away from the auxiliary bishop, staring out the open stone windows with his hands gripped together white-knuckled behind him, while he fought his anger and tried to throttle his despair. He'd already put Make into an invidious, even a dangerous position, and he knew it, just as he knew all the reasons he shouldn't have done it. There were limits to what even the most broad-minded Schulerite could overlook at a time like this, and he had come perilously close to that limit, which was particularly reprehensible when the Schulerite in question was trying so hard to do what he knew was decent, despite the all-too-real danger into which that plunged him. "You're right, my lord," the Earl said at last, still facing the panorama of the harbour beyond the windows. "We are sons of Mother Church, and we have no choice but to obey the commands of her vicarate and the Grand Inquisitor. Nor is it our place to question those commands. Yet speaking purely as a layman, and as the commander of one of Mother Church's fleets, and the only effective fleet she has left," he added silently, "I must express my concern about the future implications of this decision. I'd be derelict in my duty if I didn't, and—" "Stop, my son," Make interrupted, cutting him off before he could continue. Thirsk looked over his shoulder at him, and the auxiliary bishop shook his head. I know what you're about to say, and based purely on military logic and the reasoning of the world, I agree with you. This is going to create a situation the heretics are only too likely to seize upon as an excuse for carrying out atrocities against the loyal sons of Mother Church, and I fully realize the way in which it's likely to adversely affect the other side's willingness to grant our soldiers and sailors quarter in the first place. From that perspective, I can't argue with a single thing you're about to say. But as the Grand Inquisitor has reminded all of us, his eyes stabbed Thirsk's, the logic of the world, even the mercy natural to any man's heart, must sometimes give place to the letter of God's law. That law sets one penalty, and only one for the unregenerate, unrepentant heretic. As Shula teaches, for the good of their souls, for the possibility of reclaiming them even at the very last moment from Shanwei and the pit, the Inquisition dares not relent, lest the transitory illusion of mercy in this world lead to their utter damnation in the next. And as the Grand Inquisitor has also reminded us, at a time when God's own church stands in such peril, we dare not ignore the requirements of his law as set forth by the Archangel Shula. Thirsk's jaw clenched, but he heard the warning, and he understood. Understood not only that Meg was telling him further protest, however logically and reasonably couched, would be unavailing and almost certainly dangerous, but that the auxiliary bishop would be unable to protect him if he drew the Grand Inquisitor's ire down upon his own head. Very well, my lord, the Earl said finally. I understand what you're saying, and I accept that I must obey the instructions we've been given. As you say, the church stands in peril, and this, he emphasized the last word ever so slightly, is not the time to question the Grand Inquisitor.
Or the rest of the vicarate, of course.
Make winced. It was almost imperceptible, but Thirsk saw it anyway, and he responded with an almost equally tiny nod. The auxiliary bishop raised one hand and started to say something, then visibly changed his mind and shifted subjects. Turning from our instructions to the rest of the dispatch, what did you think of Victor Alain's analysis of what happened, my son? He asked instead. I thought it was cogently reasoned, Thirsk replied, smiling faintly and without humour, as he recognised Meg's quest for a less volatile topic. He shrugged. Obviously, the Carisians. He seldom used the word heretic any longer in his conversations with Meg, probably another dangerous habit he was getting into, have found some way to load their roundshot with gunpowder, exactly as the Captain General is suggesting. I hadn't considered the possibility myself, and I'll have to have a word with the Foundry Masters before I could hazard a guess as to how difficult it might be to cast hollow shot that don't simply break up when you fire them. But it's obvious the Carisians have figured it out. How they manage to get the things to explode when they want them to is another matter, of course. He frowned thoughtfully, his brain and professional curiosity engaged, almost despite himself. There's got to be some sort of fuse, he half murmured. But how do they light it? The barrel's too long to reach down and light it after they've loaded the gun, unless they're firing them only from carronades. And that doesn't seem possible, given the weight of fire Father Gregor reported. His frown deepened. Muzzle flash? Is that what they're using? And if it is, how do they manage it without blowing the fuse into the shell and setting it off early? Stephen Make breathed a mental sigh of relief as Thirsk was diverted from his dangerous anger. It was only going to be temporary. The auxiliary bishop knew that. But he needed to back the admiral off before his stubborn sense of integrity dug in any deeper and left him no path of retreat. Lewis Gardiner was too good a man to be allowed to deliver himself into the Inquisition's hands because of the very things that made him such a good man. And even if he hadn't been, Mother Church couldn't afford to lose the one admiral she had, who seemed to be capable of meeting the Carisians on their own terms. "Assuming Father Gregor's reports are accurate," he said out loud, "what can we do in the face of such a weapon?" "Nothing, my lord." Fersk raised both eyebrows, his tone surprised. "If they can make their cannon shot explode inside our ships, their combat advantage becomes effectively absolute. Presumably we could still get close enough to at least damage their ships, but only at the cost of coming into range at which they'll be able to destroy ours." "So there's nothing we can do?" Make couldn't hide his anxiety, and the Earl shrugged. "For now, my lord, the only response I see is to attempt to learn how to make the same sorts of hollow shot for ourselves. Until we can respond in kind, we dare not meet them in battle. In some ways, however, this may actually work to our advantage. Once we've learned how to make the same weapon for ourselves, I mean." He grimaced. "I don't see how any ship could survive more than a very few hits from something like this. And that, I fear, means sea battles are about to become affairs of mutual annihilation, which will ultimately favour us, since we have so much more manpower and so much greater capability to build replacement ships. We can trade 2 ships, possibly even 3, for each of theirs in the fullness of time. The cost in both money and lives will be atrocious. But it's one we can pay in the end, and they can't." He obviously disliked saying that, and Make's face tightened as he heard it. Unfortunately, it wasn't anything the auxiliary bishop hadn't already thought. "It's probably not a bad thing that we're going to have to spend some time trying various approaches to the problem of producing and fusing hollow shot, really," Thirst continued. "We're going to have to rebuild the Navy of God before we could even think about engaging the Carisians at sea again, especially given how the prizes they've added to their fleet will increase their own numbers. In fact, it looks to me..." He broke off suddenly, eyes intent as they gazed at something Make couldn't see. He stayed that way for several seconds, then blinked twice, slowly. "You've thought of something, haven't you?" Make challenged. The Earl looked at him, and the auxiliary bishop chuckled. "I've seen that blink of yours before, my son. Out with it." "Well, I don't know how practical it might be. But one possible solution to this new weapon of theirs might be to find a way to prevent it from exploding inside our ships." "Prevent it from exploding? How?" Make's expression was perplexed, and Thirsk shook his head. "Forgive me, my lord. I should have phrased that more clearly. What I meant is that we have to find a way to prevent it from exploding inside our ships. To prevent it from penetrating our ships in the first place. And how might we do that?" "I'm not certain," Thirsk acknowledged. "At the moment, the only answer that suggests itself to me would be to somehow armour the sides of our vessels. I don't think we could do it simply by increasing the thickness of their scantlings, though. That would seem to leave only some kind of protective layer. A sheath of iron, perhaps, applied to the outside of the planking." "Would that be possible?" Make asked, his expression fascinated, and Thirsk shrugged again. "That's a question to ask the Iron Masters, my lord. What I can already tell you from our experience with arming our galleons, though, is that producing that much iron would be, if you'll pardon the expression, hellishly expensive. I'm not at all sure what it would do to stability, either. Nonetheless, it's the only solution that suggests itself to me at this point." expensive or not. It sounds to me as if you might be onto something here, my son. Meg nodded enthusiastically. Write up your thoughts on this for Vicar Alain, please. I'd like to send them off to the temple with my next dispatch.
Of course, my lord, Thirsk said.
But the enthusiasm had vanished from his voice once more at the mention of dispatches to the temple, and Meg cursed himself for having brought them up. Not that he had much choice. Sooner or later he was going to have to talk about reports to the temple, and Thirsk was going to have to provide those reports. The auxiliary bishop stood for a moment looking at the man whose loyalty to Mother Church he was charged to safeguard. Then he inhaled deeply. "My son," he said carefully, "Lewis, I know you're unhappy about the orders concerning your prisoners." Thirsk's eyes narrowed, but Meg went on in that same careful, deliberate tone. "I know the logical arguments in support of your position, and I've already acknowledged you have a point in that regard. But I also know one reason for your unhappiness is how deeply it goes against your sense of honour, your integrity, to deliver those who surrendered to you and to whom you offered quarter to someone else's justice." Those narrowed eyes glittered icily at the word justice, but Meg allowed no answering reaction to cross his own sternly expressionless face. "You're a good man, Lewis Gardiner. One of whom I feel, I know, God approves. And a good father. Your daughters are godly women. Their children are beautiful, and your sons-in-law are men much like you, men of integrity and honour. But Shanwe's most dangerous snares appeal not to the evil side of our natures, but to the good side. She can and will use your goodness against you if you give her the opportunity, and if that happens, the consequences of the Book of Shula await you. I know you're a man of courage. You faced battle and death scores of times without letting that danger dissuade you, and I very much doubt a man such as you would allow any threat to dissuade you from doing what you believe is the right and honourable thing. But think carefully before you set out on a course such as that. The consequences you might face at the end of your journey would affect far more people than simply yourself." Rage glowed at the backs of Thirsk's eyes, flaring like a furnace, and no longer icy, at the unmistakable implication. But Meg continued unhurriedly. "I'm a bishop of Mother Church, my son. I have no choice but to obey the ecclesiastic superiors I swore to obey the day I took my priest's vows. You're a layman, not a priest. Yet it's your duty to obey Mother Church as well, although..." His eyes bored suddenly into Thirsk. "I'm fully aware you've taken no personal vow, as I have, to obey the Grand Inquisitor's instructions. Obviously, even though you've sworn no oath." He emphasized the last three words ever so slightly. "You'd be bound by duty and integrity to obey him anyway. And if, as I do not anticipate for a moment, you might be tempted not to obey him at some point, that would not absolve you of your responsibility to consider the consequences for everyone else who might be affected by your actions. And to be certain, the innocent do not find themselves drawn into those consequences. Recall what the holy Bedard said in the opening verses of the sixth chapter of her book. I commend her thought to you as you grapple with the heavy and complex burden God and the archangels have laid upon your shoulders at this time." The anger vanished from Thirsk's eyes, although the rest of his expression never even flickered. Silence hovered between them for several seconds as the Earl looked back at the auxiliary bishop. Then he bowed slightly. "I appreciate your concern," he said quietly and sincerely, "and your advice. I assure you, my lord, that I'll think long and hard before I allow anything to affect my duty to Mother Church, and I'll bear your advice, and the holy Bedard's, in mind at all times.
Good, my son.
Bishop Stephen touched him on the shoulder.
Good.
Much later, after Maker departed for shore once more, Lewis Gardiner crossed to his desk. He picked up his well-thumbed copy of the Holy Writ from his blotter, opened it, and leafed to the first three verses of the sixth chapter of the Book of Bedard. He didn't really need to read the words. Like any dutiful son of Mother Church, he knew his scripture well. Yet he read them anyway, eyes moving across the beautifully printed and illustrated page. Behold and heed, you who are mothers and you who are fathers. Let not your actions or inactions bring calamity and evil upon your children. Be instead a roof over their heads. Be walls about their safety. The time will come when they will become parents to you in your old age, but that time is not yet. Now is the time to teach and to nurture, to love and to guard. When peril approaches, go forth to meet it far from them, lest it threaten them as well. When duty calls you into danger, put them first in a place of safety. And when the threat of the ungodly draws nigh, set them beyond evil's reach before you ride out to battle, and do not let the hand of the wicked fall upon them. Oh, yes, my lord, he thought, gazing down at those words. I'll bear your advice in mind.
3. Imperial Palace, City of Tellersberg, Kingdom of Old Caris, and HMS Dawn Star, 58, off Roundhead, White Horse Reach, Princedom of Coruscant.
I hate this.
Charlian Armack sat on HMS Dawnstar's sternwalk, Crown Princess Alana sleeping on her shoulder, and gazed out across the galleon's bubbling wake at blue water, sparkling under a brilliant afternoon sun. Her canvas sling chair moved gently under her with the ship's motion, rocking her and the baby. A pleasant following breeze stirred errant strands of the long black hair, braided loosely down her back. And the green, smooth hills of Roundhead rose out of White Horse Reach to her left. She was less than 150 miles from the end of her wearisome voyage to Manchir, and she could comfortably expect to reach it before tomorrow's dawn, none of which had anything to do with the wounded, sorrowful fury in her grim brown eyes.
"We all do," Merlin said.
He stood with his hands braced on the sternwalk rail, leaning over it as he, too, looked out across the calm emptiness of the reach.
"And I think we hate it most of all, because we've seen it coming for so long.
And because there's so damned little we can do about it," Caleb agreed harshly from far distant Tellersberg. It was much earlier in the morning there, and the skies were cloudier, with a promise of heavy rain as he sat looking out a palace window across the table, set with a breakfast of which he'd eaten remarkably little. He was scheduled to meet with Duke Grey Harbour and Baron Ironhill, Keeper of the Purse for Old Caris, and Chancellor of the Exchequer for the Carisian Empire. He wasn't looking forward to that meeting, and it had nothing to do with what he expected either of them to tell him. Trying to concentrate on their reports was going to be harder than usual, but he'd have to pretend that there was nothing distracting him. He certainly couldn't tell them what was distracting him at any rate, and that made it immeasurably worse, since both of them were Sir Gwilym Manthier's friends, too.
"I'm afraid you're both right," Michael Stainer said from his office. "I wish to God there was something we could do, but there isn't." "There has to be something," Dominic Stainer protested. He'd known Manthier longer and better than any of the others, and anguish tightened his voice. "We can't just let that butcher Clintarn—" He trailed off, and the others' faces stiffened.
They knew exactly what was going to happen to any Carisian, especially any Carisian who'd been taken in the act of armed resistance to the group of four, who was dragged to Zion. And, as Caleb had said, there was nothing they could do about it. "I could take the skimmer," Merlin said after a moment. "And do what?" Caleb demanded even more harshly. Dominic Stainer might have known Manthea longer, but Sir Gwillem had been Caleb's flag captain at Rock Point, Crag Reach, and Darkos Sound, the man who'd sunk his own ship in his desperate effort to reach Caleb's father in time. "What are you going to do?" the Emperor continued in that same unyielding voice. "Not even Sejin Merlin's going to be able to rescue a couple of hundred sick, wounded, half-starved men in the middle of an entire continent. It's a coin toss whether they're going to send them by road or by ship, and you know it. But say they choose the overland route. Even if you manage to single-handedly slaughter every single guard, how do you get them out of East Haven before the rest of the damn Temple Guard and the Dalaran army catch up with you? Not to mention the little fact that you'd leave scores of witnesses to something which would be flat-out impossible even for a Sejin. And even if they decide to send them by sea, how are you going to help them? Blow the transports out of the water? That would at least keep them out of the Inquisition's hands, give them a clean death. And don't think I don't realize what a blessing that could be, Merlin. But if Father Pater's right, and there really are archangels sleeping under the temple, don't you think the possibility of using advanced weapons that close to the temple is likely to wake them up? That's a valid point. But we can't just let ourselves be paralyzed worrying about it from here on out either, Merlin replied. Merlin, I understand how badly you want to help our people, Archbishop Makel said. But Caleb's right about the risk, too, and you know it. Of course I do. Merlin's tone came far closer to snapping at Stainer than anyone was accustomed to hearing from him. But Dominic's got a point, too. Like Caleb says, better to at least send them to the bottom of the ocean cleanly than let Clintan torture them to death for some kind of spectacle. Merlin, Charlian's voice was soft, and she reached out to rest one hand on his mailed forearm. None of us wants to see that happen, and any one of us would do anything we could to prevent it. But Caleb's right that we'd never be able to get them off the mainland if they choose the overland route to Zion. And if they send them over water instead, what do you think would happen if all their transports sank in clear, calm weather? Do you really think that anyone would accept that as some kind of freak coincidence? She shook her head as he turned to look down at her. Everybody would know it wasn't that. So what would Clintan and the others do if it happened? They'd proclaim Shan Wei had claimed her own, Dominic Stainer put in harshly. Which is exactly what they're going to claim after they torture them all to death anyway. But this time they'd have a clearly miraculous disaster to back up their claim, his older brother pointed out. It wouldn't make a lot of difference to any of our people, but it would be fodder for the Group of Four's propaganda mill. Frankly, that wouldn't stop me for a moment, Caleb said. He picked up his chocolate mug and drained it, then set it down beside his still well-laden plate with considerably more force than usual. My problem is that I can't get those sleeping archangels out of my brain. Merlin would have to use the skimmer's weapons, Dominic. It'd be the only way he could put them down. And if I'd been the paranoid setting up something like Father Pater suggested is under the temple, I'd damn well have everything within hundreds of miles of my bedroom covered with sensors that could hardly miss energy fire. I'm afraid he's right, Dominic, Merlin sighed. It may be plain, blind, dumb luck I haven't already triggered some kind of detection wandering around Haven and Howard the way I have. I'm inclined to think it's more likely, because nothing I've done so far has crossed any threat thresholds they may have established. The skimmer's electronic and thermal signatures are actually a lot weaker than the ones from the regular air cars the archangels were flying around in at the time of the creation. It was designed to be extremely stealthy against first-line tactical sensors, and they weren't. I suspect that if anyone did set up some kind of sensor perimeter, the skimmer's signatures don't reach whatever level they established as representing a threat. But energy weapons? He shook his head. If they've got a sensor net up at all, they couldn't miss that. Couldn't we cobble up something else? Edwin Houseman asked. The Ironmaster stood on the balcony of his office, gazing sightlessly out across the sprawl of his huge and growing complex. Surely you've got some missiles in inventory in the cave, Merlin. Couldn't we use them? The only heavy projectile weapon in my cave are kinetic energy weapons, Merlin said. Their drives would be just as detectable as energy weapons. They might even be more detectable, frankly, depending on what thresholds they set up. Owl might be able to cobble up something cruder and less efficient. In fact, he probably could. But anything he came up with would look even more like the Rakurai, and still might cross the line. But if they don't have a sensor net up, Gwilym and all the others are going to die under the question and the punishment. When we could have saved them, or at least killed them cleanly, Dominic said flatly. We owe him, we owe all of them, at least that much. Are you prepared to take that risk when the first thing we'll know, if there is a net and we cross the line, as Merlin puts it, is when whatever the hell is under that obscene mausoleum in Zion wakes up? Caleb demanded, his voice even flatter and harder than Rockpoint's. I know he's your friend, Dominic. He's my friend, too. And I'm his emperor. His oaths were sworn to me, not you, and I swore oaths to him in return. If there's a single human being on the face of this planet, including you, who wants to save him more than I do, I can't imagine who it is. But pretend for just a moment that you didn't even know him, and the decision was solely up to you. Would you truly risk sounding an alarm that brings a genuine archangel with control of Langhorne's Rakurai back to the Group of Four's aid? Silence sang and crackled over the comm for endless seconds. Then, no, Dominic Stainer said, his voice almost inaudible. No, I wouldn't, Caleb. Churchill and Coventry, Merlin. Caleb said almost as softly, and Merlin winced. Charlian looked up at him, one eyebrow raised, and he shrugged. An episode from World War II back on old Terra, he said. It was an example I used with Caleb once in Coruscant. And it's still a good one, Caleb put in. I don't like it. Like Charlie. I hate it. But somebody's got to make the call. And for better or for worse, it's me, and ugly as this is. As much as it's going to stick in my craw and choke me, I don't see another option. For that matter, Dominic, if we could tell Gwilym the entire truth, what do you think he'd recommend? Exactly what you just have, Your Majesty. Stainer spoke with unwanted formality, yet there was no trace of doubt in his voice. That's what I think, too, Caleb said sadly. 4. Weaver's Guildhall and Royal Palace, City of Manchia, Princedom of Coruscant. Patrick Haintry stood on the walkway around the water tower cistern atop the Weaver's Guildhall. The tower's facade was a kaleidoscope of sheep, angora lizards, spinning maidens and busy looms, all carved into the Barkor mountain granite of which it was made. It was one of the best-known tourist attractions in Manchia, but Haintry didn't care about that as he gazed out across the city of his birth and swore with vicious, silent venom, while the galleons flying the black, blue, and white banner of the Empire of Caris edged delicately towards the Manchia wharves. The sun was barely up. The air was still cool, with that smoky blue edge that comes just after dawn. The wind-powered pump, which kept the cistern filled, squeaked softly, almost musically behind him, and the air was fresh from the previous evening's gentle rain.
It was going to be a beautiful day, he thought rancorously, when it should have been ripped by tornadoes and hurricanes. His hands clenched on the walkway railing, forearms quivering with the force of his grip, eyes burning with hatred. Bad enough for that bitch Emperor should be visiting Coruscant at all, but far worse to see city draping itself with bunting, decorating its streets and squares with cut greenery and flowers. What did the idiots think they were doing? Couldn't they see where this was heading? Perhaps it looked for now as if the accursed Carisians were succeeding, but they'd set their puny, blasphemous wills against God, damn it. In the end, there could be only one outcome for mortal men vain and stupid enough to do that. The air began to thud, and the harbour fortresses blossomed with spurts of smoke as their guns thundered in formal salute to the arriving Empress of Caris. The waterfront was the better part of a mile from Haintree's vantage point, yet even from here he could hear the cheers go up from the packed wharves. For a moment, his entire body quivered with a sudden urge to fling himself over the railing, to plummet down to the paving below and put an end to his own fury. But he didn't. He wouldn't let the bastards be shed of him that easily. He stared at the incoming galleons for another moment, then turned his back resolutely and started towards the ladder. He had a final inspection to make before he could sign off on his current assignment, and then he had his own preparations to see to. He descended the ladder with the confidence and ease of practice. There was little left of the silversmith he'd once been as he swung down the rungs. That Patrick Henry had disappeared forever 14 months ago, when Father Adrian Wayman was arrested by the Carisians' Coruscantian flunkies. Fortunately, before that happened, Henry had taken Father Adrian's advice to heart and established an escape plan all his own, one no one else had known anything about. And because he had, he'd managed to elude the terrifyingly efficient sweep of Sir Corin Garvey's guardsmen. He still wasn't certain how he had accomplished that, especially since they'd been hunting him by name and with a damnably accurate description. But if he'd needed any evidence that God himself was watching out for him, he'd certainly had it, as Father Adrian's entire organization was smashed to flinders in a matter of days, and he wasn't. And the other thing he had had evidence of was that the only way to avoid arrest was to operate completely independently, to trust and recruit no one. At least a dozen other efforts to organize resistance against the occupation and the abomination of the Church of Caris had founded in the last year. It was as if Garvey's guard had eyes everywhere, ears listening to every conversation. The only way to avoid them was to say nothing to anyone. And so Henry had found new employment with the City of Manchester's Construction and Maintenance Office. He'd grown a beard, cut his hair differently, changed the way he dressed, gotten a colourful tattoo on his right cheek and the side of his neck, and found himself a room on the other side of the city where no one had ever seen or known him. He'd gone to ground and become someone else, who'd never heard of Patrick Henry, the rabble-rouser. But he hadn't forgotten Patrick Henry, and neither had he forgotten his duty to God and his murdered prince. They'd taken everything he'd ever been from him when they forced him to flee with a price on his head, yet that had simply added to his anger and his determination. Perhaps he was only one man, but one man, properly motivated, could still change an entire princedom. Or even an empire, he thought as he neared the ground. Or even an empire.